Cubberty on 2FM with Super Value Travel Insurance. Holidaying at home or abroad? Don't worry about a thing with Great Value Travel Insurance at supervalue.ie.
Burns, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan.
The world is safe, I hope.
Yeah, I think so.
Better be. Let's get straight down to business. Can you ask, Nina, I'm here, here I am. Hang on, is that to do? No, it's totally different. That's babies. Okay, strike that. My sister's 12-year-old son is still wet in the bed. And other than that, he's a totally happy young lad. What should we do? 12 is old, isn't it, for that? Or
well,
is it?
It is and it isn't. I mean, yes, most children are toilet trained kind of by the age of, you know, 2, 3 or 3 anyway, particularly. But in saying that, what they call nocturnal enuresis, which is the medical term for bedwetting, mm-hmm. Can go on much longer, often in boys, and it tends to run in families. So it's really worth asking, did his parents on either side or aunts or uncles have a history of bedwetting? And if they did, what age did they stop bedwetting? So if he has wet the bed all along and never been dry at night, it's not as much of an issue and it usually eventually settles itself down. It is worth going along to the GP, having a check-up. You know, one of the simple things to do is to restrict fluids in the evening. A lot of people drink a lot before they go to bed. Obviously, really important to go to the toilet before they go to bed. What they say is if they wet the bed, they're often, you know, they're really, especially at that age, they're mortified, they're embarrassed. They often won't go stay in friends' houses. So it can have a real social impact because they're afraid because they don't want friends to know that they do this. So not to run them down when it happens, you know, not to give out to them for wetting the bed because obviously it's not something that they're consciously doing or want to do. Often to leave kind of clean sheets and that in the room so if it happens that they can actually get up and tidy their bed themselves. There is some medication that can be given that just helps reduce the level. There's a hormone that helps us produce urine and you can use some medication that helps knock that at night so you don't produce as much urine at night. So do talk to your doctor. But what I would say is if he has always been dry, always been wetting the bed, and there's a family history, he is likely to grow out of this and is not likely to be an underlying problem. If someone has been dry by night and suddenly starts wetting, that's different and they need to be checked out more medically for that.
Okay.
But the big thing is it's not to stigmatise them. This is actually far more common than people think.
Well, that is a relief.
Yeah.
And that'll be a relief to hear, no doubt about it. Can you ask Nina about Meniere? It looks French.
Meniere's disease.
Yeah, is it common in Ireland? Can you offer advice?
I don't know that I would say it's common in Ireland. Meniere's disease is where you get, it's tinnitus or tinnitus, what people call, and a ringing in the ears and a dizziness. Vertigo and tinnitus together, basically. It varies hugely from person to person. Some people have very prolonged symptoms. Some people it goes on for a while. There are, again, it's really important to go along to your doctor, have, you know, your ear, nose and throat checked out, make sure there's no reason for this to be happening. Sometimes they do, particularly if it's one side, you'll get a scan to make sure everything that looks normal, that there's no structural abnormality that's leading to this. Mm-hmm. Then it's down to managing symptoms. And there are actually very specific kinds of hearing aids that can help with the tinnitus that's associated with that. So again, talk to your doctor and, you know, go along and get your hearing checked. For some people, unfortunately, it does run a prolonged course.
I'm 19 years old on Kerazet. While I was previously very slim, but I've put on some weight, mostly I've developed quite a large bum. Is this related to the pill?
A large bum?
Bottom.
Okay, Cerazette is a form of progesterone-only pill. So there are different types of pill. The one, when people refer to the pill, they're normally referring to one that contains estrogen and progesterone. Cerazette is one of what we call a progesterone-only pill. It is a method of contraception.
Okay.
There's been the pill and contraception in general, I think we said it last time, it's some of the most researched medicine in the world, okay? Because of what it was, there are probably, you know, far more studies on the pill than there are on many other medications. So we actually know an awful lot about contraceptives. I could take 10 women on any method of contraception. 3 will tell me they gained weight, 3 will say they lost it, and the others will say it made no difference. So I always say to people, there is no evidence in studies to show that methods of contraception make you gain weight, but you will always see some people on a certain method say they've gained weight. There's no specific reason why your bum would get bigger than the rest of you, except for genetically some women are more predisposed to gaining weight on their hips and bum and thighs than they are in other parts of their body. What I would say is look and see, has your diet changed? Are you eating more? For some people, the hormones in the pill have a slight, what we call, steroid effect in the body and their appetite increases. So clearly, if you eat more, you may gain weight. Some people hold on to a small amount of fluid. Go talk to your doctor. I mean, you may be able to just switch contraceptive and it might suit you better. If you're on a progesterone-only method, there might be a reason you couldn't take one with estrogen. Mm-hmm. So obviously you do need to talk to your doctor about that. You know, women who have a particular type of migraine or have a history of clots and things can't take the pill with estrogen. But don't put it down just to the pill. I've seen so many people, you know, swap off a certain method of contraception and the weight doesn't change. And what I will always say is don't just stop using a contraceptive, because obviously one of the quickest ways to gain weight is to be pregnant. So, you know, don't if you're happy with the contraceptive otherwise, maybe look at lifestyle stuff to try and get the weight in check as opposed to just blaming it all on the medication.
I'm in my mid-20s and I've never had any skin issues in the last few months, though I've had such dry skin and I've been getting loads of different rashes on my hands and my arms as well as some hives and dry patches. It's weird that it's started so suddenly and I don't know what it's in relation to, really.
Okay, go along and have a checkup. A simple thing like an underactive thyroid can actually give you dry skin. However, this time of year as well, if you're indoors and there's heating on, you know, the air can be drier, your skin can get drier. One of the most common causes of dry skin is not drinking enough fluids. So I know I say it a million times, but we're back to drinking loads of water. Moisturising. The amount of people who take hot showers, use very perfumed products, any of those products that suds up will dry your skin. So it's really important to moisturise after a shower, and I can't say that enough. Pat your skin while it's damp, put a moisturiser on head to toe, drink loads of water.
Any moisturiser or hydrocortisone? Or
No, hydrocortisone is a steroid, so you don't use that as a moisturiser. I mean, obviously if you have eczema, you're right, if it's inflamed, angry skin, we'll use a steroid to calm it down, but that's not a moisturiser, that's acting as an anti-inflammatory actually. So just a moisturiser. If you've a tendency towards dry eczema type skin, do use one designed for that, and there's a number of different products that are designed for eczema to skin. Talk to them in the pharmacy. There's a number of very good products made here in Ireland, so you know we can always support the home industry as well.
Of course.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say, but this Elav is an Irish brand. I like to promote Elav, Irish,
yeah,
and it's good. But what I would say is moisturise, watch your skin, but if it's unusually dry, go along, get some blood tests on your thyroid. If your iron levels are low, your skin can change. Also, vitamin Bs, you know, can cause changes in different parts of your skin. So go get it checked.
Mildly related, I've had a strange allergy lately, mid-30s, female. I get patterns of uncontrollable itchiness on different body parts at different times, such as my legs, back, shoulders, etc. No pattern. When I lightly scratch it, my skin comes out in lumps and red. It has been suggested it's stress. I've changed my washing powder, so I think it is that. It can wake me up at night, and the itch can be very irritating. I don't know who to go and see or how to tackle it. I wondered if I should be taking an antihistamine or look at changing my diet.
Okay, well, if it started after you changed your washing powder, which I think is what she said, I would definitely obviously just switch back and see if that makes a difference. Dry, itchy skin, again, we've just talked about it, can be down to a whole host of causes. Sometimes it's an allergic basis, but there are lots of other causes. Stress can be one. So yes, you can take an antihistamine no matter what the cause is, but obviously if you can identify a specific cause, that's always better. Other than that, again, go along for a checkup if you are under stress. Don't forget that that's equally important to address. And obviously if you've unusual itch, again, they'd probably do some blood tests, changes in the liver and that can cause itchy skin. So, but it sounds most likely that if this happened right after changing your washing powder, it would seem to maybe switching washing powders again.
Review the washing powder. My 5-year-old daughter has a ketotic hypoglycemia for 3 years. Blood sugar levels as low as 2. Have been told she will grow out of it but may develop diabetes. How likely is that to happen?
Okay, that's a very specific condition, Ryan, and it's not one I'd have a huge amount of experience of. So, I mean, a ketotic hypoglycemia would be really rare. The only thing I would say is obviously diabetes is a condition where you get high sugars. So I would imagine that child is attending a specialist, and I think to discuss the very specific risks of diabetes might be best discussed with your specialist.
Good thought. Sometimes I get a little dizzy and then start shaking inside, and it lasts a few minutes as a text. Should I see my doctor or is it nothing to worry about?
They get dizzy and
a little dizzy and then shaking inside and lasts a few minutes.
Okay, again, back to fluids. Make sure you're drinking enough water. One of the most common causes of feeling dizzy, again, is just being dry, dehydrated. So make sure if you have a tendency to feeling dizzy, especially if it's if you stand up or turn or something, drink plenty of fluids. Eat well, eat regularly through the day. And again, you know, no harm if your diet's not great. Go along, get some blood tests, things like low iron, low B12, thyroid changes, all those can do it. But what I would say is the most common cause of feeling a little funny and dizzy is that you're either overtired or you're dehydrated.
Do you think the dehydration is a problem?
I think it's huge.
People,
I think people don't drink enough fluids.
Here?
We really don't drink enough fluids, like 1.5 to 2 litres of fluids
a day.
Now, it doesn't just have to be water. If you think about it, though, like yogurts, ice cream, you know, anything that you like, a sauce, they all count as liquids. But the problem is a lot of the liquids we're drinking are things like tea and coffee, which have caffeine, which are natural diuretics.
So it's cancelling it.
And also, if you're drinking lots of caffeine, you're more prone to feeling dizzy because it can make your heart go faster and that as well. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of, I always have bottles of water around me, and I'm a big fan of the bottles because at least you can say, right, I've had my 500 mils, or I've had, you know what you've drunk.
It's measured rather than glasses.
Just really consciously try and drink at least 6 glasses of water a day, and then hopefully, you know, you'll get the rest of your fluids in your diet.
What do you think about the other comment I read out earlier about the woman who's just freaked out because everyone keeps warning her about how horrible it is to have a baby?
I didn't hear that.
Everyone's going, oh, be careful. It's going to be so scary and you'll never sleep again and you'll have rows with your husband and your house will never be clean. And she's just this culture of people.
She's expecting her first baby,
yeah.
Is she?
And she's going, why are people just constantly coming out with the negatives about having a baby? You know, oh, God, are you having a baby? Oh, God, it's awful. It'll be desperate.
You and I are both parents. Yes, it's life-changing. And yes, Quay, you're sleep-deprived and, you know, there are things that go with it. But God, do you ever regret it, David?
Not for one second.
No, it's a wonderful... Yes!
But I think some people are head-tilting doomsayers, and that's the way it is. Yeah. They love to come up and go, oh, that's awful, and they're delighted. I think they get a kick out of gloom.
I do think it's good for people to be able to talk about any negative feelings associated with something. Because I do think, on the other hand, I do see, you know, mums who've had babies who come in who are finding it difficult and they're tired and suddenly everyone around them is, you know, saying how wonderful it should be and they find it hard to say, actually, this is hard. But on the other hand, even when they're finding it hard, there's not one of them would say that they regret a David.
Yeah.
They are absolutely in love with their baby. And someone said to me once, and I totally believe it, you'll never know how much your parents love you until you hold a child. And then you realise, you know, everything else fades, basically. You know,
it
there's
does.
Nothing more important. And so I wish that lady the best of luck, and you are about to experience one of the most wonderful things in your life.
That's exactly. I tend to say the same thing. I say you might get a little tired, but it's the best tiredness in the world. It's worth
every
second.
When you look over and this little baby cooing at you, you know, no matter how tired you are, you're still smiling.
Here I am, 25 minutes in, says the text, trying to get my one-year-old puke-saturated car seat cover off, bottle of Flash Febreze in tow to kill the smell. It's very hard to see the positive. The sweat's pouring off me. Children are the best thing that life can give, says another. Despite the tiredness, you will go to the playground, beach, cinema and laugh in ways you can never imagine. I've had that pleasure for 26 years and the fun, joy and satisfaction is still happening. Have lots of children. Another. Children are the best thing that life can give. Despite the tiredness, you will go... No, I just did that. I had to pull over to text because that really struck a chord with me. I always tell expectant parents that my six-year-old son is the best thing that ever happened to me and the hard work is well worth it, and it gets easier as you go along. Ryan had a ball when both babies were born. Pregnancies were fun, babies were great, and maternity leave was a lot of parks, visiting friends and going shopping. Both slept through the night from 3 to 4 months old. I'd love another. Okay, now you're just boasting. I don't have children yet, but I notice we're living in a culture that fears childbirth because it infringes on our ideas of bodily perfection and control and our perception of the ideal modern woman who has everything under control. While that is the beauty of having a child, everything changes. As a college student, I would love to be able to go to the bathroom without it being overwhelmed with posters relating to birth control and abortion, which only serve to instill fear about one of the most beautiful and awe-inspiring of human capabilities. To the lady who texts in, you are about to understand the extent to which you can love another human unconditionally. How amazing is that? And worth being publicly celebrated. Congratulations and all the best.
Yeah, exactly.
Strong feelings, eh?
Strong feelings.
Louise is on the line and she wants to have a quick word with Neil. Good morning, Louise.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Good morning, Louise.
Hi.
What do you need to know, Louise?
Well, I've just been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. I'm 37 and it's not in my family or anything, and nobody can explain why I got it. I'm just confused, I suppose.
Well, Louise, I think the important thing is there are obviously two types of diabetes. There's type 1 and type 2. And type 2 is the kind that tends to run in families. Type 1 doesn't tend to run in families. And unfortunately, I can't actually tell you why you got it. We don't actually know why people suddenly get type 1 diabetes. But type 1 diabetes is the one where for some reason your body is just not producing any insulin. So you have to take insulin in order to help use the sugar effectively in your body. So obviously there's an awful lot of research still going into type 1 diabetes. It's one of those conditions that we don't know as much about as we would like to know. However, what I would say is we've learned an awful lot about how to manage type 1 diabetes. And the really good news is that once you're diagnosed and once your sugars get under control, you know, that you can lead a perfectly normal, healthy life. And I think that's really important. People worry that when they have it, that somehow they won't be able to do all the things they want to do. And even now, you know, we used to years ago have very, very restrictive diets for people with type 1 diabetes. They weren't allowed to eat anything with sugar. They had to be really careful about how many carbohydrates they eat. And now I know, you know, I have friends who are diabetic, and I know now that there's an awful lot of freedom in what you eat once you learn to adjust your insulin doses with it. There are excellent, excellent diabetes centres throughout our hospitals. Where do you live?
I live in Atoy, in Kildare.
Yeah, there's some excellent diabetes centres throughout the hospitals around Ireland. So just use those services. They have excellent diabetes nurses. Make sure that you get to see the dietitian, that you get to see all the different people on the team, and just to get all the information that you need to help feel in control. Because it's very frightening to face into a long-term illness and you feel that Like you're worried it's going to take over your life.
Yeah, it's kind of a bit of a shock. Like, to,
of course it is.
All of a sudden, it's out of nowhere. Like, yeah. So I'm waiting to see the diabetes or the dietitians and that and specialists. So
yeah, and have
hopefully they'll be able to.
And have they started you on some insulin and that? Have they?
I'm only on insulin now about 3 weeks because first of all they thought I had type 2.
Yeah.
I went to the doctor, I had high blood sugar.
Right.
And they just said, oh, you've just got type 2 diabetes. But I was on glucophage and Diamycon and Dranamin, a few different ones, and none of them are working. So I ended up going in an ambulance then.
Right.
And I was in Nays for 5 days.
Right.
And then they just said, well, look, we've just got type 1. Here's some insulin. I'm just like looking for more information. Really, I'm waiting to see specialists and stuff. So.
Oh yeah, well, just make sure that your GP does follow that up and gets you the appointment, because I think once you actually have the information that you need, you'll start to feel a bit more comfortable with it, because you can start being in control. And I think that's the really scary thing of a chronic disease, is if you're someone who's been well and you're not used to being in hospitals or being sick, is feeling that has to become part of your life. And you know, just remember that it's the quality of your life that's important, and just to get under control so you can live the life that you want to, and you can. You'll be able to do all the things you want to do.
Oh, that's good news.
Okay.
So were you quite shocked by all of that, Louise, when you were told?
Oh yeah, when they said it was type 2, everyone was like, oh well, that's the good type, you know.
Right.
But you'll be fine, like, you know, just take a few tablets and be careful what you eat. But so I was like, oh really, there's a good type? Okay. So I was just kind of getting used to that, and then I was like, no, you've actually got type 1.
Oh god.
So I was like, oh, is that the bad one? Do you know? So
yeah.
And then people tell you loads of stories, you know, like, and kind of find you go, oh god, you know what happened to me? Like, I nearly went into a coma. You know, you hear all these horror stories, so it's a bit scary, but...
Do you know something? It's funny, we were talking about the babies earlier on. People love to tell you this bad stuff. I mean, it's absolutely amazing that they're so insensitive. You've just told them this awful news that you're just trying to get your head around. They go, well, you think that's bad? This is what might happen. And you're sitting there going, what the... what part of you thinks I want to hear that story?
Yeah, I know.
You know,
you don't want to hear that.
You know, you don't want to hear that. You just want to sit at home, watch TV for the next 2 weeks and get away from the world, probably.
I was told a long time ago in medicine that you don't give people information they haven't asked for. And I always think that's a very good rule of thumb in life. Like, a lot of people feel that they're somehow helping you by telling you all this stuff.
Yeah.
And some people actually just want to know. So, you know, I'm on the other hand, I'll always answer any questions I'm asked, but I don't think in life at all you should force information on people.
It can help. Well, Louise, I wish you well with all of that. So good luck with everything.
Thanks a million.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Nina, I'm frequently being diagnosed as a text with UTIs, and I'm a healthy young woman and have had these problems for years now, and it's now really affecting my love life as I cannot have intercourse as it causes extreme unbearable pain, but the doctors still don't know what's wrong.
So UTIs being urinary tract infections, and they're very common in women, particularly around intercourse. In fact, they used to refer to the term as honeymoon cystitis, because when women started having intercourse, they would start developing urinary tract infections.
Okay.
Part of the reason is obviously the passage from the outside to the inside is much shorter in women than in men. So bacteria that can normally live in the skin or in around the bowel can go inside much easier, and the friction of intercourse makes that much more likely to happen. A couple of things, if it seems to be related to intercourse, some simple things you can do is, again, we're back to make sure you drink loads of water. Avoid dark coloured drinks, so your red wines, your coffee, your tea, caffeinated drinks are bladder irritants, avoid them. But going to the toilet before and after intercourse can help. And there are some people, if you very much get symptoms right after intercourse, some of the specialists will prescribe you an antibiotic where you just take one after intercourse, because they say that, I can't remember the exact percentage, but a huge percentage of women, if you check their urine after intercourse, will have bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of women clear them and it never bothers them. But for some reason, some women then develop symptoms and develop bladder inflammation and infection. If you're getting recurrent urinary tract infections, another thing we do sometimes is give you a low dose of antibiotic to take every day for about 3 months, just to kind of calm the bladder down, stop any bacteria growing there. But if you're still getting infections and they're affecting you, obviously we do refer people on to specialists to have the bladder checked out. You can get a thing called interstitial cystitis, where you get a kind of a infection that gets into the bladder wall. And again, you know, using antibiotics for a few months can help that. But the simple thing, going to the toilet before and after intercourse can make a big difference. Rinsing down with water before and after intercourse. And then talk to your doctor about whether you need to take a low dose antibiotic at night or even have one to take after intercourse.
Okay,
we see it all the time. It's very common.
There are problems to, there are solutions to the problems.
There are solutions. The problems, and I don't want it to affect your sex life, so I think do talk to someone. Yeah.
Good. Well, let's leave on that chirpy, upbeat note for this morning. Nina Burns, thank you as always.
Thank you, Ryan.